The title of this sermon is Protecting the Unborn. If you want to open up your worship guide and take some notes, Protecting the Unborn. And so we're going through this sermon series that has the same title as our Christmas offering, Send It Ahead. And so what we've been doing in this sermon series, and today's the last Sunday in the series, but we've been tackling each of the issues that we're raising money for and just talking about why they're important and why they deserve our time and our energy and our attention and our money. And so what we've said so far is, just to recap, the idea or the concept of Send It Ahead is that when it comes to your money, you can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. When it comes to your money, when you die, you can't take your money with you, but you can send it on ahead. And what that means is that Jesus taught, and the Bible teaches, that the way you get your sins forgiven, the way you're reconciled to God, is by putting your faith in Jesus Christ as your Savior and Lord, and as God's payment for your sin. And God forgives your sin, and God saves you, comes into your life. And so salvation is a free gift, and salvation is by grace through faith. However, the Bible teaches that the level of your reward, or the size of your heavenly reward, and the level of your joy in heaven, well, that depends on what you do in this life. Heaven is a free gift for those who put their faith in Jesus, but the size of your heavenly reward, your heavenly treasure, depends on what you do in this life. And Jesus said in Luke 12:33 that one of the ways that you can build up your heavenly reward is by giving to the what? Giving to the poor. That's right, giving to the poor. And so we've been talking about there are different kinds of poor that you can give to. We've talked about the financially poor, which is the most obvious. Those that don't have enough money to make ends meet. We've also talked about the spiritually poor, which are the most poor of all, those who are lost without Christ. But then last week and this week, we're talking about a different kind of poor, a different kind of poverty that most people forget about, and that is those that are legally poor, those who don't have equal rights and protection under the law. And last week, we talked about Christians in the United States who are under attack right now because of their religious beliefs concerning marriage and gender and things like that. This morning, we're going to talk about one group of people in our society that are perhaps the most vulnerable and the most under attack in all of America, and that's the unborn. The unborn, the preborn, unborn children are the most poor in the United States because they're in the most danger. I said before that the most dangerous place to live in the United States is not in Chicago, in the inner city of Chicago. It's not in the inner city of Washington, D.C. None of you would want to live there. But the most dangerous place to live in the United States is actually inside a mother's womb, because there it's actually legal to kill someone. If a human being is inside the mother's womb, it's okay to murder that person. And so we're talking about protecting the unborn this morning. And I want to start off this morning by talking about a subject that you may not have thought was related to abortion, but that's the subject of infanticide. Infanticide. Infanticide is the intentional killing of infants. The intentional killing of infants. And you actually find infanticide has been practiced for thousands of years, and you find it all through the Bible, actually. Not promoted in the Bible, but you find it in the Bible. For example, you can go all the way back to the story of Moses in the book of Exodus. If you remember, the Hebrews at the time were in slavery in Egypt. And so the Egyptians saw how rapidly the Hebrews were populating, increasing in population, and the Egyptians saw their increasing population as a threat. And so Pharaoh ordered one day, he said, okay, from now on, he ordered his people that any time a Hebrew boy was born, they were to kill the baby by throwing it into the Nile River. Do you remember that story, the story of Moses? And that's a case of infanticide. But the Egyptians weren't the only ones who were guilty of infanticide. God's own people, the Israelites, would later, as they inhabited the Promised Land, they began to even practice infanticide, not as a result of God's command, but as a result of being influenced by the surrounding cultures. Whenever they moved into the Promised Land, one of the neighboring people groups that they were influenced by were the Ammonites. And the Ammonites worshipped the god Molech. And one of the ways that Molech was worshipped was with child sacrifice. Molech ordered, according to the religion, Molech ordered that people would take their children and burn them alive on the altar of Molech. And the Israelites actually adopted this practice for a time period, and God's own people were killing their own children. In fact, that wasn't the only time. A little bit later in history, the Israelites adopted another form of idol worship. They started to worship the god Baal, Baal worship. And part of Baal worship was also child sacrifice. The idols of Baal were made out of sheet metal. And the belly would be hollowed out of this idol of Baal. The belly was hollowed out, and that's where they would make the fire, in the belly of Baal. And they would take their children, their infants, who were alive, and place them in the belly, the fiery, burning belly of Baal, and they would kill their live children. It was another form of infanticide that the Israelites actually adopted. Then we see infanticide also in the Christmas story. Do you remember this? When Jesus was born, the king of Judea at that time was Herod the Great. Herod the Great was not great. He was a great builder. That's how he got his name. He was a great builder, but he was a horrible, horrible person. Herod murdered his wife. He murdered three of his sons. He murdered his mother-in-law. Herod murdered his uncle, his brother-in-law. Many others were murdered by Herod as he suspected them of treachery, of trying to steal his throne. Well, when the Magi, or the wise men, went to Herod and asked him, where was this newborn king of the Jews born? That got Herod's attention. And so Herod found out that the prophecies said that the newborn king was going to be born in where? In Bethlehem. And so Herod sent his men out and ordered them to take all of the newborn little boys in Bethlehem, 2 years old and under, in Bethlehem and in the surrounding countryside, and to kill them. Can you imagine how horrible that must have been? All these little baby boys, 2 years old and under, in and around Bethlehem, were killed for no reason. But then if we look past the New Testament, the time the New Testament was written, into the first century, which was really during the time that the New Testament was written, but we don't find this written in the pages of the Bible. But what was going on at that same time period in the first century, second century AD, was a popular form of infanticide called exposure. In Greco-Roman culture at that time, it was actually illegal and considered amoral. It wasn't immoral, it wasn't considered bad, it was just amoral, but it was legal. That if a parent didn't want their child, what they could do is simply take the child and leave it at the edge of a forest or leave it at the edge of a river. And that was called exposing the child, or exposure, because they weren't actually killing the child. They were just leaving the child to its fate, leaving the child exposed to the elements. Now, if the child got rescued, if the child survived, great. But if the child didn't, it's not their fault. It's not murder. They didn't kill the child. They just exposed it to the elements. It was a very popular form of infanticide during the time of Jesus and the apostles in the early church, called exposure in the Roman Empire. And it's interesting, in 380 AD, whenever the Christians came into power finally, and Christianity at that point became the official religion of the Roman Empire, one of the very first laws that was changed was the law of exposure. That became illegal. Christians said, we're not going to allow this to happen anymore, because what Christians were doing from the very first century is whenever the Christians would find a baby that was being exposed on the edge of the river, on the edge of the forest, Christians would take that baby in and Christians would raise it as their own. And so when they finally came to power, they said, no more exposure. Now, the reason why I'm talking about infanticide and sort of a history of infanticide in the pages of the Bible all the way through the first century is because when we hear about the intentional killing of infants, all of us in this room agree that that's evil. In fact, everybody in America, just about, except for maybe a small, small minority on the fringe, agrees that infanticide is both immoral and should be illegal. It should be against the law. In other words, nobody in America is pro-choice when it comes to infanticide. Nobody in America believes that infanticide should be something that should be allowed. For example, nobody is protesting in Washington, D.C. for the rights of women to choose to kill their own infant if they want to. Nobody says about infanticide, well, infanticide may be against your religion, but don't impose your religion on everybody else. Nobody says that about infanticide. Nobody is making the argument that mothers should be able to commit infanticide in the cases of incest and rape. You know, normally infanticide would be bad, but if the mother got pregnant because of incest or rape, well, she should be able to choose, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years after the baby's been born. If she changes her mind, she should be allowed to kill that infant. Nobody is arguing that. Nobody's making that case. Nobody is saying that if you are against infanticide, you must be against women. Nobody's saying that. We all agree that infanticide is evil and it should be illegal, and it is in the United States of America. But if that's the case, since that's the case, then why do so many people in America support abortion? Because infanticide is simply the intentional killing of infants. Abortion is simply the intentional killing of an unborn infant. That's all it is. It's another form of infanticide. And so if we all agree that infanticide is evil and should be illegal, then why is there any disagreement when it comes to the issue of abortion, of killing, the intentional killing of unborn, preborn infants? Well, I'll tell you why. This morning, I want to talk to you about why pro-abortion activists believe that the preborn are subhuman. You see, they believe the reason why you should be able to kill an unborn child is because, well, it's not fully human. It hasn't reached full personhood. It has the potential to be a human. It's on its way to becoming human. It might become a human. It might become a full person, but not yet. And since it's subhuman, since it's not quite fully human, therefore, they don't have and don't deserve equal protection and equal rights under the law, like you and I do. Now, I want to tell you why. I want to give you four reasons why pro-abortion activists believe that the preborn are subhuman. And these four reasons can be remembered with the acronym SLED, S-L-E-D, S-L-E-D. If you'll remember these, then you'll be more eloquent at making the case for life. So four reasons that unborn children are supposedly subhuman. The first one, S, is size. Size. The argument is that since unborn infants, or fetuses as they call them, are so small, then they must not be fully human. Since they're so small, they must not be fully human. But that argument is absolutely ridiculous. It's subjective. It's arbitrary. And I'll give you a reason. I'm 6'4" tall. My wife is 5'6". I'm almost a full foot taller than her. Does that mean I'm 1 foot more human than her? Does that mean she's not quite as human as me? Does that mean that she doesn't have as many rights as me because she's not as big as me? To give even more obvious example, my youngest son, Wrighton, is in second grade. And compared to me, he is tiny. He is tiny. I mean, he comes up somewhere around here to this level here. I mean, really, really small compared to me. He's growing. But he's very, very small. Does that mean that he is subhuman? Does that mean he's not as human as me? Does that mean he doesn't have all the same rights and protections under the law as I have? Of course not. Of course not. He's a human being. Size has nothing to do with it. My wife is a human being just as I am. Just because I'm larger doesn't mean I'm more human. And so this idea that size determines your humanity is absolutely ridiculous because it's arbitrary, it's subjective. In other words, if size is what determines your level of humanity, well then what size do you need to be considered human, fully human? And who gets to make that decision? For example, how large do you need to be? How large does a baby need to be fully human? 20 inches? 19 inches? 15 inches? 10 inches? 5 inches? Who gets to make that decision? And what's the difference between 15 and 20 that makes the child suddenly fully human. You see, it's completely subjective, completely arbitrary. Size has nothing to do with your humanity. The second argument given for why the unborn are subhuman is level of development. The L in SLED stands for level of development. And the argument goes like this. Since unborn infants are not fully developed, then they are subhuman. Since they're not fully developed, then they are subhuman. But again, I'm going to give you the same types of arguments, the same types of analogies to show you how ludicrous this idea is. My 13-year-old daughter just turned 14 today. She's no longer 13. Now, she is an underdeveloped woman. She is developing into a woman. She's going through puberty right now. She's still going to grow taller, she hopes. She's still going to grow in a lot of different ways. She's still developing in many different ways. But the point is, she's not nearly fully developed. She's got a long way to go before she's completely developed. Does that mean that she's less human than my wife, a fully developed woman? Of course not. Does that mean we should be allowed to kill her because she's not fully developed? Or go back to my son, my youngest son in the second grade. He is not nearly fully developed. He's got a long way to go before he is a fully developed adult. Does that mean that he's subhuman, less than human, not fully a person? Does that mean he has less rights than the rest of us? Of course not. Does that mean we should have the right to kill him? Can you imagine how ludicrous that is? Do you see how that sounds? And again, this idea that level of development is what determines humanity or full personhood is wrong because it's completely subjective. It's arbitrary. In other words, at what point of development does a fetus become a full human being? And who gets to make that decision? Some scientist? Some politician? For example, how developed does a fetus need to be a human? Is it when the fetus has a heartbeat? Well, that occurs 18 days after conception. Is it when all of the fetus's organs are functioning? That occurs just 8 weeks after conception. Is it when the fetus has its own distinct fingerprints? That occurs 9 weeks after conception. Is it whenever the fetus can feel pain? That occurs 10 weeks after conception. Is it whenever the fetus can smile? That occurs 12 weeks after conception. But who's to say that what part of development means that a fetus is fully human and has full personhood and all the same rights that we have? Who's to say? Or is it whenever the fetus has its own unique DNA code? Well, that happens the moment of conception. And this is why, from a purely biological standpoint, and I'm not a scientist or a biologist, but according to Dr. Jaime Gordon, the founder and director of the Mayo Clinic's world-renowned medical genetics program, he says, from a purely biological perspective, all life, including human life, begins the moment of conception. That's when life begins. That's when a child has its own unique DNA code. And so, level of development does not determine humanity. Okay, number three, this third argument that's given for why the unborn are subhuman is environment. The E stands for environment. That just means place or location, environment. In other words, pro-abortion activists argue that the unborn are subhuman and they don't have all the same rights and protections under the law that we have. They are not fully persons, well, because of where they are. They're actually inside of the mother. They're inside the mother's womb. And since they're inside the mother's womb, well, they don't have full rights. The mother has rights over them. That means the mother must have the right to kill the baby if she wants to. And so the idea is that location or environment is what determines a person's level of humanity. But of course, that's ridiculous. You are a human person. Maybe the first time anybody has ever told you that. You are a human person. And you know what? You're a human person here at Celebrity Theaters. And you are a human person at your house. And you're a human person whenever you go to work or school. And you're a human person if you would go to Mars. You're still a human person, human being. If you went to the moon, you're still a human person. You see, your location has nothing to do with your humanity, does it? Where you are does not change your humanity. It doesn't change your identity. You are a human being here, there, and everywhere. It doesn't matter where you go. If a newborn baby is a human person the instant that it's born, well, then common sense tells you that it's a human person the instant before it's born, right? And if a newborn infant is a human being the instant before it's born, then that means it's a human being when it's inside of its mother. And if an unborn baby is a human being, a full human being inside of its mother, then that means that abortion is murder. You're killing a human being. And then finally, number four, the fourth reason that pro-abortion activists give for saying that the unborn are subhuman is dependence. D stands for dependence. And the argument that's made is that since the unborn are so dependent upon their mother for life, well, then the mother has the right to kill them. They don't have full rights. They don't have full protection under the law because they're fully dependent upon the mother. But that's completely ludicrous because there are many people in our society that are fully dependent upon others for their survival. Think about infants. We've been talking about infanticide. Well, newborn infants, six-month-old babies, two-year-olds even, are completely dependent upon their parents or their caretakers for survival. They cannot survive on their own. Newborn children are completely dependent. Does that mean they're subhuman? Does that mean that they don't have rights? Does that mean we have the right to kill them if we want to? Of course not. Or what about patients in the ICU, in the hospital? Patients in the intensive care unit. One time, I visited a man in the intensive care unit, in the ICU, in the hospital, and this man was in a coma, and he had tubes in his nose, he had tubes in his arms, he had tubes going in his mouth. He was in the hospital, in a coma, in the ICU because he had overdosed on crystal meth. He was completely dependent upon those machines and upon those people for his life. If they would have unhooked him, if they would have walked away, he would have died just like that. Does that mean that those people had the right to kill him? Does that mean he doesn't have equal rights, equal protection under the law? Does that mean he's less than human because he's dependent upon others? Of course not. And so your dependence doesn't determine your level of humanity. And so what I wanted you to see is those are the main four arguments that pro-abortion activists use for why the preborn or the unborn are subhuman and therefore they don't have equal rights and therefore it should be legal for a mother to kill her own baby. Those are the arguments and they're completely bogus. They're completely ludicrous. They don't make sense. Unborn babies are as human as you and me. They're as human as newborn babies. They're as human as infants. And just as we all agree that infanticide is a horrible evil that should be illegal, so abortion is a horrible evil that should be illegal. And so what that means is that in the United States of America, the country we're so proud of, the country we love so much, the land of the free, right now murder is legal. Infanticide is legal. You know, we think about the cultures that practiced infanticide and we say, wow, what barbaric cultures those were, so uneducated, so unenlightened. But here we are today in the 21st century, and infanticide is legal on a mass scale. And since 1973, over 60 million unborn children have been murdered because of legalized abortion. 60 million, 1.2 million, 1.3 million every single year. So what should Christians do about abortion? If you have a Bible, you can turn to Proverbs chapter 24. Proverbs chapter 24. What should Christians do about abortion? Well, one thing that a lot of churches do is they choose to not touch this issue with a 10-foot pole. This is a church, after all. We should be preaching the gospel, not talking about politics. Well, God calls us to love our neighbor. And that includes our unborn neighbors. And so one of the ways that we can love them is by talking about abortion, because right now it's okay, it's legal in our country to kill them. So let's talk about it. Proverbs 24, 11 through 12. It says this, rescue those being taken off to death. Rescue those being taken off to death and save those stumbling towards slaughter. If you say, but we didn't know about this, won't he who weighs hearts consider it? Won't he who protects your life know? Won't he repay a person according to his work? I want to make three observations about this text. Number one, you are to rescue those who are being murdered. You, won't you look at your neighbor and say, you. You are to rescue those who are being murdered. You're not allowed to be uninvolved. When you know that there are people in our society, in our culture, who are being murdered, who are being led away to their death unjustly, you are not allowed to turn away and not get involved and pretend like this is not happening and just to not care and just to mind your own business. You're not allowed to, biblically, as a Christian. You, it says, rescue those being taken off to death. Save those stumbling towards slaughter. You're called to get involved. How can you help the unborn from murder? How can you save them? Let me give you a few suggestions. And we could go on and on about all the different ways you can get involved in the issue of abortion. Number one, and these are all sub-points under number one there. But first of all, I want to encourage you, and I used to not even bring this up. I used to not even say this, but it's becoming more and more clear to me that this needs to be something that you need to consciously decide. First, make a firm commitment never to have an abortion and never to encourage someone to have an abortion. If you're going to save the unborn from murder, you personally need to make a commitment that you're not going to have an abortion and you're not going to encourage those others to have an abortion. You know that a majority of the people in the United States who have abortions are self-proclaimed Christians. You know, we live in a nation that's the vast majority Christian. Well, who do you think's having all these abortions? Who do you think's encouraging all these people to have abortions? It's self-proclaimed Christians. And so the first thing we can do as a church is you can make a commitment. Parents, if your children, let's say your daughter gets pregnant because of rape or incest, what are you going to tell her? You know, I had a friend at work, and he's an atheist. So this should actually fit his worldview. But we're talking about the issue of abortion. And the issue of rape and incest came up. And I said, well, in the issue of rape or incest, well, it's not the baby's fault. You don't kill the child because of the sins of the parents. Sure, rape and incest are horrible things, and the raper, the rapist, and the committer of incest, they should be castrated and killed, murdered. I mean, put to death. I mean, horrible. But as far as that innocent child, the child deserves to live. He said, no, it doesn't. He said, Andy, if your daughter got pregnant because of rape or incest, you're telling me you would tell her to keep the baby? I said, absolutely, absolutely. He said, not me. He said, I would tell my daughter to have an abortion. I said, it's a human being. He said, I don't care. We need to make a decision, first of all. We're not going to seek abortions. We're not going to encourage others to seek an abortion for any reason whatsoever. That child is a human being. A second thing you can do is to vote for pro-life politicians. Vote for pro-life politicians. Never vote for a politician who is in favor of murdering children. It sounds so intuitive, doesn't it? It's like, should I have to make the case for that? Should I have to back that up with reason and logic and statistics and make a case for that? That you shouldn't vote for a politician who wants to kill babies? And by the way, this means that you need to vote. You need to vote. Never miss an opportunity to go to the polls. The reason why it's legal to kill unborn children in America is because Christians and non-Christians, American citizens, have voted for politicians who have appointed judges who have decided that it should be legal to kill unborn children. That's why abortion is legal in the United States of America. One of the reasons why I didn't vote for President Obama was because I didn't like his name. I'm just kidding. You know, a lot of people voted for him because he's black. Yeah, I had better reasons to not vote for him. And one of those reasons was because he's a strong pro-abortionist. I mean, he thinks being pro-abortion is a mark of compassion on women. I just really, you know, love women, want them to be able to murder their children. And so I couldn't vote for him. But you know, in 2012, Barack Obama won the election by about 2 million votes. Whenever he ran against Mitt Romney, 2 million votes. Was that who he ran against, or was it the second time in 2012? Was it McCain or Romney? McCain? Romney. McCain was the first time, McCain and Palin, and then Romney was the second time. So he lost to Romney by 2 million votes. It was estimated later that about 9.4 million conservative registered voters did not vote in that election. In other words, 9.4 million pro-life citizens who are registered to vote didn't go to the polls and vote for that election. As Christians, we can easily win every election. We're the evangelical Christians and Roman Catholics who we agree with in a large degree when it comes to political issues. If we would just go out there and vote, we could pretty much decide every election. But the reason why same-sex marriage is legal, the reason why abortion is legal, is because Christians are civically unengaged. And a big reason for that is because for the past 50 to 80 years, pastors have not been preaching about politics because it's divisive and because some people might leave the church. No more of that at this church, okay? Politics isn't everything, but politics is important. Politics can't save people from hell, but politics can make it illegal to own slaves. You know the reason why slavery is no longer legal in the United States? The reason that Jim Crow laws are no longer legal in the United States is because some Christians had the courage to get involved in politics, and some Christian pastors had the courage to preach about politics. I like what Martin Luther King Jr., Dr. King, said one time. One time, his peers, you know, he was a pastor, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he was a pastor, and he was criticized for getting involved in politics. And different people said, you know, I don't know why you're getting involved in politics. You should stick to the gospel. It's not the job of the church to get involved in politics. Just stick to the gospel. And let me quote from him. He said this. He said, "It may be true that a law cannot make a man love me, but it can stop a man from lynching me." And that's pretty important. Politics isn't everything, but that doesn't mean it's unimportant. And so as Christians, it's not the job of the church to influence politics, but it's the job of the church to teach Christians how to live out your faith at work, at home, and as citizens of the United States of America, how to take your faith with you into the public square. And that's what we're doing. What does it mean to be pro-life, by the way? Because that's really what you need to do. If you want to save the unborn, politically speaking, you need to be pro-life. A lot of people say, this is the problem with a lot of Christians, a lot of well-meaning Christians have this view, is the idea that, well, I am pro-life. In fact, a lot of Democrats say this. I am pro-life personally, but I am pro-choice or pro-abortion politically. Because, listen, there are a lot of, who's the guy? Chris Matthews, right? Did y'all know Chris Matthews is a Roman Catholic? Chris Matthews, I think his show is Hardball, or it used to be Hardball, but he's very, very liberal politically, and he's a strong Roman Catholic. And so he says, personally, he's pro-life. He can see that it's wrong. But politically, he's pro-choice. He's pro-abortion. Because after all, who am I to impose my religious beliefs on others in a free, pluralistic society, right? Well, you know, that argument is so ridiculous. I mean, what if you were to say, personally, I'm against rape. Personally, I'm against rape. But who am I to impose my views on those other men? And so politically, I'm pro-rape. It doesn't make sense, does it? Or to say, personally, I'm against murder, but politically, I'm pro-murder. Because who am I to impose my views? It doesn't make sense with abortion either. What does it mean to be pro-life? The Human Coalition has written the pro-life declaration. If you know Brian Fisher from American Family Radio, he's the founder of this organization called the Human Coalition. You can go to their website. And they've written the pro-life declaration, which you can sign. It has over 350,000 signatures by now. And it defines what it means to be pro-life. Here's what it means. I believe every life has dignity and limitless potential. I believe the right to life is the most fundamental right protected by America's founding documents. I believe life should be protected and defended from the moment of conception until natural death. And I believe grace, compassion, and understanding are essential to protecting life. Another thing you can do to rescue the unborn is to support crisis pregnancy centers. And this is what our Christmas offering is going to support. There's a local crisis pregnancy center in Lafayette, which many of the churches in Lafayette support this crisis pregnancy center. It's a Christian ministry. And they take these young women who are considering abortion, unplanned, unexpected pregnancies, and they're considering abortion. They try to reach out to these young women. They try to share the gospel with them and lead them to Christ, but they also try to persuade them to keep the baby. They offer them help and resources and all kinds of things to try to convince them to keep the baby, and they're very effective at doing this. And they have these Christian crisis pregnancy centers all across the country, and one of the most effective methods that they use to convince these young women to keep the baby is an ultrasound. They show these women for the first time that they have a living child inside their womb. And what's amazing, what the research has shown, is that over 90% of the time, when a woman who is on her way to having an abortion, when she sees an ultrasound, she changes her mind and decides to keep the baby. 90% of the time. And that just shows that these young women do not know the issue. They do not know that they're carrying a human being inside of them, because they've been told that's not a human being. And so part of our Christmas offering, one third of it, is going to the local crisis pregnancy center. So I encourage you to give to the crisis pregnancy center. Another thing you can do to rescue the unborn is to educate yourself on the issue of abortion, so that you can do exactly what I'm doing right now, but maybe even better, hopefully. You can make the case for life in your circles of influence, with your friends and with your family and on social media, that you can speak up for the unborn. You say, but yeah, but that's so divisive. I don't like to talk about politics and religion. Listen, God, remember what we're reading in Proverbs. You need to speak up. You need to get involved. You need to rescue and to save the unborn. And so a couple of books. I have a book on the table over there, on the offering table. I have about 10 copies up there of a book called Why Pro-Life by Randy Alcorn. And you're welcome to take a copy as you leave. Many of you have already gotten that book because I've given it away before, but if there's still a copy left by the time you leave, or the first come, first serve, but grab you a copy. That book is a short book, and it's a wonderful book. Another one that's probably the best book on the issue of abortion is called The Case for Life by Scott Klusendorf. It's a weird name, I know. But The Case for Life by Scott Klusendorf, it's one of the best recommended books on the issue, but I want to encourage you to educate yourself so you can make the case. Let me make two more observations about Proverbs 24. Two more observations. Number two, and these are quick. If you don't rescue those who are being murdered, God will know it. The first one is that God commands you. He calls you and me to get involved, to save those, to rescue those who are being murdered. Here's the second one. If you don't rescue those who are being murdered, God will know it. God will know it. Verse 12 says, if you say, but we didn't know about this, won't he who weighs hearts consider it? Won't he who protects your life know? There is always, and there always will be, the temptation for Christians to not get involved in hard issues. And when it comes to the issue of abortion, it's much easier, it's much safer, it's much cheaper to not get involved, to not touch such a controversial issue, to not get involved in politics. It's much easier just to not get involved. There's always be that temptation. But biblically speaking, we don't have that option. And this text in verse 12 says, if you don't do anything about this, God will know. God will know. God is watching you. It matters to him. And that brings us to the third observation. Number three, God will repay you. He will repay you for what you do about those who are being murdered. God will repay you. That sounds like a threat. Well, that's exactly what the text says. So take it up with the text. God will repay you. Look at verse 12, the end of verse 12. This is exactly what the text says. I think we ignore these very, very scary texts sometimes. It says, won't he repay a person according to his work? And so here we are as Christians. We're safe. We've got food in our bellies, a roof over our heads. We've got full rights and protection under the law. And it's so much easier just to not get involved in those controversial political issues. But the Bible says God knows when you're taking that stance, and God will repay you. What does that mean exactly? I don't know, and I don't want to find out. It doesn't say, but I don't want to find out. And so let me conclude by just reminding you that we're talking about this morning the issue of infanticide. We're talking about the intentional killing of infants and how that's immoral, and we all agree that that should be illegal, and yet in the United States of America, it's legal to kill unborn infants. It's legal. And they're being killed by the millions every single year. And that can change. And it will change. And it has to change. But we've got to get involved. We've got to protect the unborn. And so I want to encourage you to go out there and embody the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is all about God sending his son Jesus to sacrifice everything to save us from death. And so let us be like Jesus and go out there and do what we can, do what we need to do to sacrifice ourselves for those who are being put to death unjustly.